Welcome to the new season of Supercharged, the Change and Comms podcast. In this season, we digitally globetrot to find out more about change and cultures in a variety of different countries, including the USA, India, back to the UK, Malaysia, Kazakhstan, and Denmark. But in this first episode, we're off to Australia to meet with Gilbert Crowdenier and Peter Fan. We're super delighted to welcome both Peter and Gilbert onto the pod. Peter and Gilbert are currently living in Australia. Gilbert is a mega experienced change and comms pro. And what's super cool about Peter is that he visualizes change and both have worked together for a number of years. We're going to explore how these things come together. But before that, as always, Pete, hello. It's cold here in England. It's -6. It's white outside. I'm sure you're going to tell me it's warmer in Barcelona.
Mildly warmer. Still morning here. And I'm just really looking forward to seeing how this podcast goes because we're all so far away from each other. So good evening to our guests in Australia. So if we start with Gilbert, hello. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what do you do?
Hi. Yeah, I'm Gilbert. I live in Brisbane. I am a change manager by trade most of the time. Currently, I work for a super retail group on a number of HR projects. Before that time, I've spent a lot of time in education land for various universities. I do some consulting in the disability and aged care sector about governance, human rights, which is another passion project for myself. And when I'm not doing that, I enjoy working with Peter on books and cards and crazy videos. So it keeps me entertained most days.
My name is Peter. By day, I'm an engineer. I specialize in energy efficiency. So all about reducing the amount of electricity you consume in buildings. And by night, I visualize change using cartoons and animations through my side hustle, Flimp Studios, which I've been running for about 10 years now. So working on all sorts of projects relating to change and strategy and whatnot. And been working with Gilbert for a number of years as well. And just having a lot of fun.
What got you interested in change and visualizing it in that way?
What got me into, I think it was more so a coincidence. So during my uni days, I joined a social enterprise and I was part of the marketing team. So drawing and cartooning was something that I've always been interested in. And so I sort of pursued that as a side thing during uni. And what got me into change was that I had illustrated a change process as part of that student organization. So we went through a rebranding exercise. And so I drew a whole, you know, sort of one-page illustration and animation that explained why we're going through that rebranding exercise. And one of the sponsors was actually a change consultant. And he saw what I did for the organization. And so I had worked with him through a number of organizations with him. And I thought, you know, this is a pretty good business model. So I thought I reached out to various change consultants. And that's actually how I met Gilbert. You know, Gilbert had, you know, come to Melbourne, what was it, maybe 9 years ago, maybe 10. And yeah, I just reached out to him, see if he wanted to catch up for coffee. And that's how our friendship began.
I see. Okay. So what was the first project you did together?
Ooh, that's a good question.
What was our first project?
It wasn't...
Salvation Army?
I think it was the video for the Salvation Army that we worked on together, but that was 2017. Ooh, this is a long time ago.
Yeah, I think it was the Salvation Army.
Yeah, could very well be. That was a good one, though. That was very helpful. It was about implementing a new national disability insurance scheme and getting people across what they needed to do and how to prepare. That was a lot of fun.
So what we ended up doing was creating a animation view that sort of talked them through the changes. So, you know, what's the current state, you know, illustrating that, what's the future state, illustrating that, and then, you know, how it's just going to get there.
Do you find, like, people, in my experience, they respond so much better when you can properly visualize something in a way that kind of is engaging? And I find, even for myself, I have to kind of draw out what's happening to get my head around it as well. How do you see that reaction in your audiences when you use those kinds of cartoons and animations?
Well, I've got the very unfortunate situation that I'm the words person in our collaboration. So every time we make something, people are like, oh, this looks amazing. Nobody ever talks about the words. So I feel very hard done by. But the reality is what we tend to do, our process for as far as we have one, is we script something out. Often just in words and crazy ideas, we show each other videos and it has nothing to do with what we're doing. We're looking for style. We're looking for a narrative. And then we parse it in little pieces and go like, okay, so how would this work? How would that work? And what we're doing is visualizing with words and then even descriptions of what the image should look like. And then we just freestyle off that because we still haven't figured out. And we always say to people, like, we're not keen on figuring out how our chemistry actually works because maybe we'll break it. But it just works. I do the words. Peter does the images. We do a second take. We change some of the words because sometimes they just don't work with the image that we've created. Then we finesse the image and that's the end result. And that tends to work really well with the audiences.
I'm looking at one now. It's the words and the animation on there. I'm screaming at it because it's something I've been dealing with all week as well. And it's it's one that you did 2 months ago with Pedro, the project manager, where change managers and project managers are the same. And it's nailed it. I can't get back into the pod. I'm reading these now. I'm going through them. I must have missed this whole post on that you put on, Peter. But I'm going to have to share these. I'm just going to kind of passively aggressively stick them around the office, I think, because it's like, it's so great.
It's what people do.
Yeah, I think, you know, you hear the words, you know, a picture paints a thousand. Was it? A picture paints a thousand words, right? And when you think about, you know, strategy and change and vision and all that sort of stuff, you'll find that what someone has in them, like if you read the same text, you know, let's say it's a sentence, you know, the person was walking a dog. You know, if you think of that, every one of us has a different picture in their mind, you know, depending on your history, your experience and whatnot. But if I was to draw that out, you know, everyone would have that sort of same picture, would know exactly what I'm talking about. Otherwise, you know, Gilbert will probably think of his dog, which is a greyhound, and I'll think of my dog, which is a tiny Pomeranian Chihuahua. Two completely separate dogs, but they both align with that sentence.
Did you know there's a condition called aphantasia where some people can't visualize words? I have a friend who has it, and if I ask him to visualize a man walking a dog, he can't do it. And yes. I have no idea what does come up in his head.
Those are the people that you see frowning in your workshops when they're looking at you and they go like, they have this frowning face at you and they're not angry. They're just like completely lost about what you're saying. My wife has this with directions. I've got a very visual memory, so I can walk her really through everything in the area.
So in terms of your collaboration, I'm guessing some stuff you do on the side and that's been around the like project manager, change manager type series that you did. But how do you get in and work with clients? Do you go in as a team that you kind of sell that as a package, or is it that you've got that available and you need to convince people that it's something that's worth doing?
It's often that's where it starts. And I will answer this question first because it often starts with me. And that's how Peter kept saying that I should be his marketing person because I got him into so many gigs. But often when I arrive at a client and I see what their challenges are, I know what the power of visualization is because we've done so many different things together. So I show them Peter's work. He only has to maintain his website and keep the items on there. I just sent a link to them and go like, look, if this is what you're after, I know the person who can turn this around. And because most organizations want it done in like 2 or 3 weeks instead of the normal 6 weeks that it generally takes, I contact Peter and go like, look, can you do this? And sometimes it's a whole series of things and gets quite extensive. Sometimes it's just one video, which can have a really great impact already. And yeah, so I just ended up sending clients his way, or if we needed to work together, we made a really cool interactive PDF for National Disability Services at some point, and that led to more work. But I'm often no longer involved, and that's totally fine. I just open the door and he can perfectly fine walk by himself.
You are a good marketer.
The best marketer.
His work is a good marketing material.
Do you get competition sometimes with the like internal or corporate design team as well?
Not at all.
Generally with internal, what they do is they're quite constrained with their time. They don't have a lot of resources to be able to do this sort of stuff. And at the same time, they're not experts in sort of change management and the process behind it. If you give them the instructions, hey, can you create a video that does this, 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 they can do it. But if you were to give them, you know, sort of a blank canvas, then it's a bit harder for them to do something like that. That's where typically you'll sort of engage an agency to do that. But with agencies as well, you know, they work on all sorts of projects. It's very rare that you have an agency that specializes just change and strategy. And so that's where sort of Gilbert and I sort of excel in that space because we've worked with each other so often that we really know how to sort of get that through the door when we work with clients.
That's the thing with visualization. If you can think in images and you can think in concepts, you can just see the relief almost with managers and also with internal comms. People go like, oh, this person actually knows what they're talking about. This is not going to take 7 briefings and 17 marketing people. I've got nothing against marketing people, just saying. But I've sat through sessions and I've worked with one marketing agency. They charge $60,000 to come up with a concept that I could draw in a morning. And my drawing skills are well below par. I can tell you that. It was horrendous. And then I showed him Peter's stuff and they're like, look, you can have this in 3 weeks. Going to cost you 10 grand and we're good. That's a very easy sell.
I'm tempted.
I know. What I really love though is just, you know, Peter and Gilbert, I'm looking through, it's the simplicity. And I'm not saying that to kind of, you know, underplay how good what you do is, but I think that is how good it is because you've got it to a point where, you know, the pictures and the words are in harmony. We haven't overcomplicated it with flashy backgrounds, super logos, you know, very dense layered imagery. We've got right to the nub of what the problem is between whether that's an HR manager or a project manager or a sponsor or an end user. And it has just boiled it right down, which is a hard skill, by the way, isn't it? You know, we've worked in this field, boiling something down to just get to the absolute point and then make it even simpler to understand with a picture. It's phenomenal, guys. Absolutely. I keep finding ones I haven't seen. The bad sponsor is currently my favorite. I didn't realize there were so many of those. Well, I know there's a lot of those, but I didn't realize there were so many images of those. But it's super cool, guys. It really is super cool. I'm loving it.
When I look at those, I always think, should I share that with my sponsor?
The great thing about those materials is they never really, so sponsors and people who are doing it wrong, they never really attribute it to themselves. They always laugh about it because they think it's other people, which is great. Because you can still drive the message home. But we often advise, it's like, look at this person, look what they're doing. Or, well, maybe this is something that we should avoid in the project. Or did you notice that John or Jane did that other thing? And for yourself and for all your listeners, Bad Sponsors available for free. You can just get it on the interweb. Just go to Flim Studios and it's on there. You can just download it and use those images to your heart's content. Because that's generally what we want to do with our projects. The sales generally go to a charity anyway, the National Homeless Collective here in Australia. But that's only true for Bad Change, the book, which we sell via Amazon. But all the other tools we've now made freely available because that's how we started the whole thing with the Bad Change company. We want to improve the profession. And the best way to do that, we thought, is to offer things for free. We also learned that sometimes giving things away for free is really hard.
Why?
The absence of a monetary value, people often go like, oh, it's either really, really poor quality, or they feel like they need to do something in return. You're like, no, it's free. We want you to use it. Yeah, but I don't feel good taking stuff for free. You're just like, no, just use it and do good things.
An example of that is our first book, which is Bad Change. I think we sold like more than 400, 500 copies of it. We sold it.
It's 800.
Is it 800? I can't remember on the top of my head
anymore.
You
just doubled your sales.
We sold them. But with Bad Sponsor, which is free, we haven't had that many downloads, surprisingly. So like that's comparison of, how giving it for free, people sort of, because it's free, I think there's no urgency for them to do anything with it. It's like, I can download it at any point in time. Whereas when it's a sale and people are sharing it, maybe there's more value to it because they actually bought it. Not too sure.
Do you get much feedback on that then? So, in terms of Bad Sponsor as a freebie, I've looked at that and I've gone, and I'm seeing use cases where I think, oh God, I've seen that. I know what you're saying. I've got it. Except you've done it a lot, you've articulated it far better than I could have. Do you get feedback where people come back to you afterwards and say, oh my word, that's exactly what I've seen or what I've done?
All the time.
All the time.
Just this week, I started the new job. And I have a new team and they're all big fans because that's how LinkedIn works nowadays. When you join a new job, they scope you out. So I gave them all a copy of Bad Change because, of course, I want to make friends. And they were just leafing through it. They're like, oh, this is so familiar. This is so recognizable. This is so relatable. And that is, I think, from the 800 plus books that we've sold now, we still get lovely emails from people and just text messages going like, still using it, still loving it. It's so relatable. My team loves it. It's just great. It never gets old, that feedback.
How do people use it? So, because I think that's the gap in my mind. It's easy to spot these people and to know who they are and who the bad sponsor is and so on, right? But then the fear factor comes of like, actually, how do I challenge that person? Or how do I put that into practice? Are there people that you've seen that have given you that feedback? They're like, I've used what you've said and yes, definitely, it's made a massive impact.
Yeah, absolutely we have. And the thing is, it has 50 examples of how change doesn't work, but Bad Change has more than 250 tips on how to make good change work. And the same with Bad Sponsor. It has 15 examples of poor sponsor behaviors, but 75 tips. So they're relating their situation to those tips. And again, we try to keep them really succinct. And as Chris already said, like drilling it down to the simple essence, because you've got three images to bring the message across and maybe 15 to 20 seconds of reading, and then it has to either connect or it doesn't. So, and same is true for executive leadership or any sort of people who get some feedback that might not be so positive. Their attention span is going to be very short. So you want to punctually deliver it and go like, well, this is the issue. So yeah, people definitely use it, or they run into a problem, like a leadership problem, and go like, is there something in Bad Change that I can use? Because as I like to say, everything that I know about change management is in bad change. So those 250 tips, that's it. That's all I know. And you're getting it for $34.95.
Sounds like a bargain.
I was speaking with Gilbert a few weeks ago, and we were sort of doubting the name Bad Sponsor, because with Bad Change, you can give that book to somebody and it's not targeting anybody. Whereas if you give the Bad Sponsor book to a sponsor, it's almost saying, hey, you're a bad sponsor, you need this book. So that's something that we sort of thought about and thought, oh, maybe we need to, you know, rethink if we do another one, whether we should call it Bad Sponsor or not. Because it's a bit hard to give it to a sponsor.
Yeah, I get that actually. And I was thinking, because it has a similarity in terms of one of the more famous change management methodologies, where at the beginning of the process, you have to assess both yourself, your project manager and your sponsor, and kind of give them that feedback. And like, but you're doing that at the beginning of the process, so we don't really know if anyone's particularly good or not. I always find that part of the process strange. And that's why I get your point. It's kind of like, if I give you this book, I'm not saying you are, I'm just kind of trying to help you on the journey a bit.
So I think, I just thought of it just then, you could potentially pick a chapter where they're the opposite of that, where they're a good sponsor and go, hey, you know, you're definitely not this person, and hope they read the rest of the book.
I find people, generally, they're quite open to that self-reflectiveness if you can give them.
I
think like you say, if you can be like, hey, see these other people, aren't they bad? You wouldn't do that, would you? Kind of guilt trip them into it.
But if you pick something if you pick something that's true, then it's not really guilt tripping. And then you just hope that they flip through the rest of the book and just say, this chapter reminded me of you because you don't do this.
What I always say is that the book is there to help, but it's not going to be the remedy. I mean, if it was that simple, it would be great. Like, you give a book to a person and then all of a sudden they change their minds. But it does help sometimes. Sometimes you're just that drop in the bucket where people go like, oh, now I get it, because it's often explained to them at a moment of great tension. They're like knees deep in project problems, and then the person comes and tells them how they're doing it all wrong. That's not going to land. But when they're a little bit more relaxed and they've got the book on their desk, or they just leaf through it and go like, I'm just going to take that to heart and put it down and never tell anyone what I've just learned. Because that's what we're trying to accomplish, like micro learning through funny cartoons that also have a bit of a punch when it comes to the facts that you get on the other page. And it seems to work really well. I mean, we're not any kind of New York Times bestseller, but that wasn't what we were intending. We thought that if we were going to get 250 books sold, it would be great because we were doing it for charity. And then when we had 500, we were still going. And then we had 750, and now we've just set a target for 1,000. And we'll see if we get there.
I'll be buying it in a moment. You can be sure of that.
Thank you.
When did it launch?
January 2020.
It was 4 years ago.
21.
No, 2022.
Like, no, sorry, I always get this wrong. It's horrible. I was thinking of the chameleon cards. I had the chameleon cards in the front of my mind, because that was the other project that we did, which I still love so much. And they're now also, again, for your listeners, everyone, you can just go to Flim Studios. They're free. They're available. All the materials are there. They help to decide people on a number of things in their change management roles, what they want to do, maybe design a new role, design a PD, whatever you want to do. There's all sorts of tips on there. But that is still the project that I love so much. Probably because I made them on my own kitchen table, the first draft.
The interesting thing here is, is that, you know, I'm looking at the stuff that you've got online and currently in the process of putting an Amazon order through for the book. But the fact is that the content that you put in there is the same as the experiences I see here. Probably, I'm guessing now, it translates across the world. So change across what's happening in Australia is essentially the same as what's happening here in the UK. And I guess, Gilbert, you know, from your experience, having worked over in the Netherlands as well, these challenges are not exclusive to a country or a culture. They are the challenges faced with change. Would you agree?
I would definitely agree. And I've started my change career in the Netherlands, but I worked for an American organization and I was still very hardcore process improvement by then. But while I was working there, I did my master's in change and organizational culture. So got a lot more interest in the people side of things. And then when I moved to Australia, I all of a sudden realized that Europe wasn't doing all that bad, because when I was living in Europe, it was like, oh, these people are so behind the times. And then I came to Australia and I'm like, oh, okay, they were actually quite evolved. And then I recently spoke to one of my friends in Canada and he said, look, the people that I speak to from Europe and the UK and Australia, yeah, they're ahead of us. Like, okay, this is interesting. So I always thought that Australia was very far behind. I would still say that Europe is quite leading. I don't know if that's because there's 27 countries in the size of a postage stamp, but it's just everyone needing to collaborate across all those different cultures. Maybe they're a little bit ahead of the curve. But on the other hand, here in Australia, what I really like about the culture and how they go about change. They might not be really good at it, but man, do they work hard at it. They really want it to work. They will give it a go and another go and just keep going at it until you're like, maybe you need to stop and just take a moment. But they're quick to get excited about it and they will give it a red hot go. And even if it doesn't work, well, we gave it a try and let's see what else works. Yeah, so I like that about the culture.
You know, kind of reassuring that the challenges that we face are the same, you know, in the organizations across. It's quite easy to become quite interested and think these are my problems and only exist where I work and in the place of where I live. And, you know, even just to go spin the globe around, it's over there. And going, actually, I'm seeing from the work that, you know, you're writing and Peter's drawing is that actually these are the same. This is okay. We're all right. You know, we've all got the same challenges. Maybe how we go about solving them might be somewhat different, but actually, you know, generally speaking, it's the same thing.
I think though, from, you know, coming from an Asian background though, I found that, you know, I've worked on a few projects in Asia. And I found that the challenges they face are quite different because of the cultural backgrounds. What I found the biggest difference was the fact that in a lot of Asian countries, there's a bit of hierarchy between sort of, you know, the younger generations, the older generations, and that sort of goes through the corporate world as well, where, you know, your boss is your boss and you listen to whatever your boss says. You know, I guess in Australia, for example, you know, if you don't like the change, you can sort of dispute it, you can challenge it, you can just go, no, I'm not doing it. Whereas in Asia, you know, if your boss tells you to do it, you pretty much have to do it, or they'll just fire you and find someone else that'll do it. So it's a lot. It's not all countries, obviously, but yeah, I think it's a bit more cutthroat.
If you come over to Australia, you'll find that there's still this ongoing debate about people either being qualified/certified, having actually done a master's in, or even a bachelor's in, organizational development or organizational change. And some people just feel like they've absorbed it through 20 years of working in the job and never actually did any qualifications. And for some, I would agree that they don't need any kind of training. They could probably deliver their own training. And for other people, you just really wonder, like, I'm not sure that you're a benefit to the profession, but I'm not one to judge, but I've done my fair share of training and I feel a little bit supported by my master's in change and my work at university. But yeah, there's a lot of things that you can learn about change without actually going to school if you're willing to keep an open mind and learn from others, because there's so much that you can do in community groups, in platforms, on LinkedIn. You don't have to only formally go to a school to actually learn and get a piece of paper that says that you are now qualified to talk about change.
What did you take from your master's?
People are difficult, but very important in the process. That's what okay. I took away from it, because it was basically an MBA without the financial component. So everything was very much focused on the organization. And there was a module for culture, there was a module for HR, and one about personal reflection and development, which I all really enjoyed. But it really opened my eyes to all the possibilities. And this is 2010, 2013, right? So this was well before we thought about psychological safety. Well, some people were thinking about it, but most people weren't. And we're definitely not writing books. So all that good stuff about people, I got just before I moved to Australia. And then my first job in Australia was with the ACT government in a shared services environment. If you've ever worked in a shared services environment, it doesn't get much more hostile than that. So yeah, all my people skills really came to the fore. And I'm like, oh, okay, so now I see all these human dynamics at work. And that's what keeps me in the job. It's the best part of it.
Did you find it boosted your career in that, like, you know, did people look at it on your CV and think you knew what you were saying, or they kind of ignored it?
In some cases, I think there's the one elephant in the room that always comes up somehow, like ADCAR certification. So ProSci is very big international change management training delivery organization, and they do some good stuff with data. I always feel like I have to credit them for it because they do a lot of good data work. ADCAR, everyone can make up their own opinion about that, but I once felt like I needed to get the certification because a client of mine wanted me to deliver 25 workshops for 625 people in total. I do not recommend anyone ever do that. But I did the training and it was okay. And yeah, you get the basics and then you just go like, okay, I know how this framework now fits in my total. But it's like with every other degree, how often does it really come up where people ask you like, so what sort of grades did you get in school 25 years ago? It just doesn't come up.
Maybe, yeah. Which is a good thing, I think. I remember once I'd interviewed someone and got them for the job and I got them in. And I said, oh, you know, it's really good that you've done your master's. And they said, well, all I ever really put on my CV was that I'd studied for a master's. I never said to you that I achieved it. I dropped out after a few weeks. So,
right.
Okay. That person was a marketer, actually.
It's a bit of false advertising. Can't trust marketers. Very well done.
Yeah.
Very good at marketing. I mean,
to be fair, he's beaten the bot there, hasn't he, in terms of getting your CV through those screeners. You've got the magic words on there, but you never actually said that you did it. It's quite clever.
Yes, I quite like it. Go on, Chris, you were going to say something, sorry.
No, that's why I moved on in my mind, actually. But I was just thinking, Peter, about you said about the hierarchy in some of the organisations, the Asian cultures. It's made me think about the ADCAR process, and it certainly changes the desire piece, doesn't it? You don't have to worry about that so much, because the desire is if you don't do it, you don't get your job back. So it kind of changes the burning platform a little.
Yeah, I guess a lot of the strategies wouldn't work in organizations like that.
I'm with you, Gilbert, as well, in terms of, you know, some of the methodologies. They are really useful as an approach to start something, but you're right, the further you go down into the you know, following it rigidly, you miss out on so many other things that, you know, from 20 odd years of doing it, I would not get from just following any of the methodologies solely. You have to kind of draw upon your experiences of, you know, working in different environments, delivering different types of change, and then, you know, reflecting back on the different scars that you've got from doing those. It's yeah, you're right. I completely agree. It's not one thing you need. It's lots of different experiences doing different things. And I suppose that's where your partnership works so well, in that you can draw upon those and Peter can help you really express them through the visualizations. It's really good stuff. What's next for you guys then? You've done bad sponsor, you've done bad change. What's next? Bad change.
We've got
manager?
A very ambitious project, which we call it Bad Change Camp? Peter, I always forget.
I think it's Bad Change Camp. Yeah.
Bad Change Camp. So in recent years, I've developed multiple learning courses for the organizations that I've worked in. I also teach at university. It's a completely online course. So I really enjoy the interaction with the students. Just keeps my finger on the pulse of what people are doing with change management in practice. So the course that I teach is Change Tools, but it's sort of condensed form of what Peter and I want to do. We want to deliver maybe 20 to 25 micro units of learning about very practical things, but we need to build it. We need to build all the animation. It's going to be a project that will probably take us through to 2024. And there's always weird distractions that come up and we're like, oh yeah, we should definitely do something about that. And then we're off and we get into something. But yeah, that's the next big thing. And also the only thing that we really feel like we have left of one of the big challenges to still do, because we wrote the book, we made the cards. Now training seems to be a natural progression.
Yeah, training's a big thing as well, because if you look around out there in the market, again, there's not much that's based on experience. It seems to be, again, methodology driven and not scenario based. And what I'm liking about the stuff I've read from you guys is that you're talking about the real life scenarios that, as you know, change practitioners, we all face, and you're bringing it to life. And I'm just looking through bad sponsors still on my screen there, and you have your cartoon and then you have some context in terms of the tips to overcome that. And that doesn't exist. No, not that I've seen, not, and certainly not as well as you guys have nailed it. So I've probably alienated every other guest we get on who does this stuff now, but you're the best.
I think that's the angle that we're going from. We're trying to get that sort of, make it very practical, make it lighthearted and fun, but most importantly, something that people will be willing to pick up and use or read. You know, the book, for example, the Bad Change book, the goal of that is really for it to be not something that you sort of sit through and read the whole thing. It's more so you carry around with you. And when you sort of need help, you can sort of easily flick to the relevant page and just look through the tips quickly. And then you can just put it away. It's not something that, you know, you will sort of read from the start to end and then just store on your bookshelf. Ideally, it's something you'd be proud to share, proud to carry around and just have fun using it.
Yeah, it's accessible though. That's what I like about it though. So when I'm thinking back to when I was like a young boy and the books I would read, I was never keen on reading hugely. But if you could pick up a Garfield book or Fred Bassett book, if you know what those are, I don't know, but you know, they're very similar in style. You can pick up the humor and engage with that story in three or four boxes of drawings. And then it kind of encourages you to read more and you build up your confidence in doing something. And that is what this does. It did exactly that. I'm so, so impressed.
Well, that's exactly the conversation that Peter and I had about this.
So I had a question for Peter. She was around using, like, I don't know if you've come across things like Powtoon or Canva or some of the more like assistive tools for change people that want to do the kind of visualization and animation. What's the kind of value add in terms of paying for an animator to do this kind of stuff than change managers like having a go themselves?
Well, there's nothing wrong with having a go at yourselves. You know, I've seen people use Powtoons and Canva and all sorts of programs to be able to, you know, visualize change. I think what you're missing from that is the system or process that I've sort of learned through going through so many projects. You know, today I've done over 200 projects, and I'd say that probably at least 60% of them sort of follow through the same formula. And it's that formula that sort of gets you through, you know, and I'm happy to share the formula. It's essentially, you know, your current state. You know, what are you trying to, what are the challenges you're going through today? You know, your future state. What are you trying to achieve? What are the benefits? You know, what's in it for the customers? What's in it for the stakeholders? And then it's the strategy in the middle and how you're going to get there. As long as you sort of have all three elements inside the animation or the illustration, then you've got a pretty nice picture. And then the way, and I guess what Powtoons and all the other programs, they probably won't be able to do is connect all those pretty smoothly. Right. Unless you have someone who's already got a graphic design background, then yes, they can probably do it. But it's very rare that you'll find an organization or person who's got all those skills together to wrap it up into one package. And that's sort of where I step in.
At work, we're in exactly this conversation right now on Friday on Thursday and Wednesday. We were going through this exact conversation with Powtoon and Canva and Storyblocks. And one of my colleagues, she's very gifted because she's been doing this for the past 10 years. But we're all change managers. We don't, our time is very, very pricey to just go and sit and figure things out. Today, I just spent 2 hours putting a very quick 7-slide video for 40 seconds together. It took me 2.5 hours. And I consider myself to be pretty fast because I've learned a lot from Peter. But then you look at the quality, you go like, well, it's passable, I think. But I've had multiple experiences where I've drawn up something. I give it to Peter and then I get it back. And I'm like, yeah, that's exactly what I wanted. But now it looks good. And that's, to me, the power of a graphics designer. And everyone who's worked with a graphics designer and came away from it thinking like, oh, that wasn't very good, you've hired the wrong person. Because if you've got a good one, you'll know the difference. And if you want to be a graphics designer, maybe you're inclined that way, go and do it. I think it's a really good skill to have as a graphics or as a change manager, but it's much easier to just pay them. The money is definitely worth it.
I know exactly what you mean. When you spend hours on something and you're like, I've perfected it, I've got it all down, and then you give it to a graphic designer who knows what they're doing, and they're like, yeah. Like, let me redesign that for you.
Yeah, but don't underestimate that. Don't underestimate it, because like with Peter, the reason why he can turn things around really quickly when I give it to them is because I understand his process. And when I work with other graphics designers, so it's definitely worth going through it. You go like, oh, okay, so now I know about bleed. I know about contrasting colors. I know about things that work, fonts that don't work, not too busy on the page. So if you can do all that preemptive stuff, you can have a much better conversation with the graphics designer and they go like, oh, okay, this person actually knows what they're talking about. And it also helps you to keep them focused, because some graphics designer, Peter excluded, they can go off the reservation. You go like, I asked you to draw me a cartoon with a fridge and a couple of magnets, and you came over there with a bicycle and a grocery bag. And you're like, I don't know how you got there. So don't let them get too creative sometimes.
I am completely bought into using design well, and people have these horror memories of me coming back now where I'd always say that it doesn't really, one of the most important things to get across is something has to look good, and style is massively important. And people remember it because I banged on this drum so hard for so long. But I always use an example of saying, you know, the old days of saying, you know, you can't judge a book by its cover for me are gone. Because if your comms and your change material do not look good, no one picks up the book in the first place. The cover actually has to be engaging, and it has to look good, and it has to tell the story. And then people will buy into the rest you're going to say. If it's not interesting, people aren't going to listen. You know, Peter said it, you know, picture paints 1,000 words. Style, design, change are hand in glove for me. They come together.
You've touched on that perfectly, because that's where comics and cartoons stand out. You know, graphics design, I think it's almost, well, with my generation at least, it's sort of expected that anything you present, anything you market has to look good. You wouldn't go out to market if it doesn't look good, because you're just wasting your money. No one's going to click on it. Comics and cartoons sort of stand out a little bit because they're not your usual comms. Like a PDF, for example, you know, professional looking PDF, well designed by a graphic designer, will still stand out. But if you just see a comic there, chances are you'll just go, what's this comic? And you'll sort of click through it, because we don't see a lot of comics nowadays.
I think you're right. It's quite subversive to use stuff that's not corporate to get people's attention and get them to engage with it. And I love those moments when you give people stuff like that and they're like, this isn't very professional. I'm like, nope, but you've read it.
Yep. And you learned something and you liked it because you showed it to your colleague. And that is the reality nowadays. I see this all the time. I work in a retail organization where everything is visuals. And that's all they care about. Like they shoot videos off the cuff and in a store, and you're like, that's what we're competing against. So we can spend 200 or 400 hours on creating the most beautiful collateral. That other person was just there in the store shooting a 60-second video. It's already out there. So yeah,
that is actually a challenge I have with sponsors now. It's when really I think the thing that it's like you say, video is such a powerful tool. And then I'll go to a sponsor and say, really want you to do a video blog or just do something on camera. And it, typically they're this, I don't know what it is about sponsors or execs or people leading this kind of stuff. They're like, no. I want you to write a press release for me. I'm like, oh, it's so like not engaging, but it's hard, right? To force people to be on camera is difficult. Maybe animation helps with
that. So you can create a mascot. You can create a caricature and then they can just do a voiceover.
Yeah.
And that's a lot easier.
I like those. Yeah, I like those. I imagine there'd be some sponsors out there going, you are not turning me into a cartoon. You have to have a lot of faith in your designer, don't you? A lot of faith.
Or you just create a new character altogether. Right? It could be like a dinosaur, it could be a blob, it could be anything really. And you can just turn that as a mascot of your project. Or it could be the sponsor that you really wanted but never had.
The conversation that I really like to have with sponsors around that is like, you know what, your avatar, you can completely control. It won't have a coughing or a sneezing fit. It won't have a bad day. It will always look super schmick. You will always wear your suit or your attire, whatever you dress in that day. You can just always look good. You can be on 24/7. We can control the pitch of your voice. We can control everything about your brand. And some people love that because their appeal and appearance is everything to them. And it's because of their role. But I really enjoyed the stories that Peter always shared with me about when he does video training with executives, how they're supposed to sit, how they're supposed to hold their head and not fidget. And they turn into small children. It's a beautiful story.
Yeah, I mean, do you do a lot of video, Peter?
Yeah, I do. Not a lot, but it's part of it. Sometimes what I do is, as part of that, the change process is, sometimes you have to get the sponsor on the camera. And so when I do get them, we've got the full team there filming everything. And then sometimes for people who are a bit more nervous and don't have a lot of time, we might just record their voiceover. And then we just, sync it to an animation video. So again, just trying to get the sponsor out as much as possible, but it depends on their speaking level and how comfortable they are in front of the camera. Not everyone's made to be in front of the camera.
No, sure. I heard you say about sitting, actually. One of my top tips I've always given to anybody who's worked with me is that we never film someone sitting down. Because they never maintain their height. They slip, they smooth, and it just doesn't land well. But if you height, you can't shrink and you can't grow. you're generally, your camera and your height angle is always pretty much spot on.
Well, here's a trick. You can make them sit on the edge of the chair. If you make them sit on the edge of the chair, it's very hard for them to slouch.
Oh, okay. Look at that. Tips coming out like these. There we go.
Don't let them lean back. If they lean back, they'll move around. But if you make them sit on the edge, no armrests, generally they'll sit up straight and they can only sort of lean forward a little bit or back, but it's very hard for them
to do. That is a great tip. That is a great tip. I'm taking that one for myself.
And stools are really good. If you get them on the stools, it's not comfortable, but they're generally in a good position because their leg sort of sits on the bottom part of the stool. So they're relatively
not spinning
stationary.
Ones.
Not spinning ones, no.
So it's probably an opportunity to wrap up, and I guess it'd be great actually on the subject of tips, your tips for thinking about using animation and how to use it. If you were to give maybe a top tip for both of those, what would they be? When and how, that'd be quite interesting.
I can do a little bit of both. So when, as soon as possible, and don't be embarrassed to draw out what you think will help, because good graphics designers and visualizers can work with that. And it's so helpful for them to know what you want in your head. Also helps with their pricing, gives them a really good idea of what you're looking for. It helps you think around like, what sort of format do I want? Do I want a video? Do I want a still? Do I want anything that you want? Just draw it out, because I mean, we can all draw a bit of a stick figure, and sometimes people have like super hidden talents that they didn't even know that they had. So I did a drawing course for 2 days just to learn about the structures of how to do drawings, and that's money well spent. So don't feel embarrassed that you can't draw or whatever. Draw it down, start early, write out the script, get a graphics designer involved, and you'll knock it out of the park.
From me, there's sort of two tips. Number one is, if you're trying to do animation and trying to draw and everything, remember that you're trying to draw to communicate and not to impress. So, if you're drawing, it doesn't have to be like an artwork or anything. The goal is to really communicate. So it can be stick figures, whatever it is. People will still look at it. People will still be drawn to it. As long as, just putting a little bit of effort, you'll be fine. Number two is, if you're going to draw about your change or your strategy or whatever, make sure that what you're drawing is what the sponsor's after. Because sometimes if it's a bit too detached from the sponsor, they won't be able to own it. They won't want to own it. And then you won't get a lot of traction and support, you know, launching the project. So make sure that you get that team involved, as well as the internal marketing team and the branding team, because sometimes they might sort of step on your toes a little bit and say it's not on brand. But cartoons are typically not on brand anyway. So if you just convince them that, look, this is internal work, this is, you know, cartoons, it's a different style, you won't have to go through the whole branding process.
Usually.
Those are great tips. Usually. Yeah. I've found actually more and more that internal brand has kind of become different and less strict as opposed to the external brand. The internal, you can have a bit more flexibility and there's probably a wider palette of things you can do. So,
correct.
It really helps if you work with the internal comms and the marketing people to just explain to them that you understand about the style guide and you want to respect it, but you also want to sell a good story. They're generally willing to work with you. But if you start off on a pirate course and just go like, I'm going to do whatever I want and go rogue off the reservation, they're going to like, no. I've had really good experiences with
it. Yeah, it's hard to come back from once you've gone there, isn't it? So, Pete, any closing thoughts?
Just that I've really enjoyed this episode and I'm hoping it'll be something we can put together nicely. No, I've really enjoyed that.
When you guys have done your next project, we've got to get you back to come and talk about it because that sounds super interesting.
That would be cool.
So my point earlier, it seems the challenges we face, no matter where they are on the planet, all seem pretty similar. How we deal with it might be slightly different, but the work you guys are doing sounds like it's going to, you know, land well over here and in, you know, Europe, everywhere.
We should close though with our usual completely mundane question. So we always ask every guest what their favorite biscuit is. Maybe that, I don't know, maybe this doesn't work outside of the UK, but we find it's a way of just of getting a strange insight into someone.
Yes.
So who wants to go first?
I am not a big biscuit person.
Yeah, I don't really eat biscuits either.
This is showing a lot about the British again.
When was the last time I ate a biscuit? I can't even remember the last time I ate a biscuit. Maybe a Tim Tam. It's probably whatever my girlfriend gave me.
So I'm going to have to look up what that
What's
is
a Tim
now.
Tam?
Oh, my Lord. You don't know it's what a Tim Tam is?
I don't think so.
No.
Okay, this is a lack in your education. That link needs to be included with the Flim Studios thing.
It's like not knowing what Vegemite is. Surely you know what Vegemite is, right?
Yeah, I've heard of that.
Only because of the song.
If you know Vegemite, you should know Tim Tams.
Yeah, Tim Tams are a cultural staple. You've got like 12 different sorts. They're not actually all that good, but everybody knows them, and there's even a thing called the Tim Tam Slam, which you can look up as well. It's nothing not suited for the workplace. It's just something you do with a biscuit and double dip and stuff.
Well, what is it?
You get the biscuit and you slam it on your head.
That's it. The Australian ways of having fun in the office. And
yeah.
Oh my God.
I mean, you're learning so much on a Friday. That's pretty cool, right?
This is telling me a lot about Australian culture now.
I know.
I'm not sure I can top the Tim Tam.
Don't forget to Google drop bears as well. Yes, drop bears are very important.
I know about drop bears. Yeah.
Oh, you do know that one. All right.
Damn.
I'm afraid to.
I don't. I feel like I'm missing out. I'm going to have to go.
Oh, seriously?
I'm worried that if I start Googling Tim Tam and Tim Tam slams, I'm
no,
going to go.
No, you won't. No, it's going to be totally
the
fine.
Drop bears is if you go for a walk in the woods, especially in Australia, you need to watch out for the bears that drop on you and do things.
Yeah, that's what they do. Ferocious.
Yeah. No one knows what they do.
Every day.
Oh, love it. I love it.
We've taken Chris into a strange dimension here. Thank you guys so much for doing this, and thanks for spending the time as well, because I know we've run over quite a lot from what we said we would do. And yeah, I really appreciate you guys doing this in the evening, and I've just really enjoyed getting into it. I think I've learned so much from that episode, so thank you very much.
It was great being here.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It was fun speaking to you both, and look forward to catching up.